Hello and welcome to the Anonymous Anthropologist Podcast with your host, the Anonymous Anthropologist. That's me. I am a community college professor of anthropology with more than 10 years of teaching in the classroom and a master's degree from Columbia University. I'd happily tell you more about me if only I could be sure that it wouldn't get me fired. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I am the Anonymous Anthropologist here with you today to talk a bit about the weather, about a couple of girls named Sandy and Katrina. First, I want to send my best hopes for healing and recovery out to the people of New York and New Jersey who are struggling right now with the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy, Hurricane Sandy. As you may know, I am a native New Yorker, and I have family living, or trying to live right now, in one of the epicenters of the damage, that tiny sandbar known as the Rockaways that sits between Jamaica Bay and the Atlantic Ocean just across the way from Brooklyn. At its widest point, there are four city blocks separating those two bodies of water, Jamaica Bay and the Atlantic Ocean. And on this past October 29th, they met, and every house in between became an island. Cars floated past people's windows and into each other, filled with sand and water, and people who had been ordered to evacuate but were either unable or unwilling were trapped on the highest floors of their homes because under the rising waters was the threat of downed live wires. Trees fell on houses, destroying them. These trees fell on people. Neighbors watched dozens of homes burn to the ground, powerless to do anything about it and wondering if they themselves would make it through the night. At the time of this recording, 12 days later, there are still no vital services to the area. No power, no heat, no lights, no gas, no phones, not even cell phones because the cell towers are out. So if you're old or ill or you need help, there's no way to call for it. The post office is gone, so there hasn't been any mail delivery yet, and the cars are mostly totaled, so it's hard to get around, and there's a gas shortage anyway. The mayor has just instituted gas rationing, like I remember back in the 70s. The boardwalk that I walked so many times is broken up and washed away for the most part, and the businesses are all destroyed. People have no homes to go back to, and those that do have no heat, no light, no emergency services. I haven't seen anybody talking about the looting, but I know from my family there that that's happening too. Stories are circulating, I don't know if they're true, about people posing as FEMA workers, Con Ed workers, breaking into empty homes. Across Long Island, there are still over 100,000 homes without power today. It's a story echoed in communities all up and down the coast of New York and New Jersey, where people are suffering similar consequences. My heart goes out to all of those who lost family, who lost friends, who lost homes and businesses, and in some cases, who lost most of the evidence they had accumulated of the lives they had lived to this point. My heart goes out to all of you, and to all of you who are still suffering without heat or light or basic services. My heart also goes out to the people of New Orleans, who suffered a similar disaster from which they have yet to recover completely, even though it was 7 years ago. So, the question is, does this have anything to do with anthropology? Does an act of God, a natural disaster, have anything to do with the study of human beings? Well, yes, a lot, actually, because we can talk about at least a couple of things here. For one, we can talk about the contribution that human cultures make to growing the possibility that a natural disaster will disrupt them in the first place. And second, we can talk about the archaeological evidence that we have of the human influence on natural disasters of the past. When I say that human cultures make a contribution to growing the risk of a natural disaster, I don't mean risk in terms of if or when a disaster will occur, but risk in terms of how many lives it will claim when it does, or how much and precisely what will be lost. On some level, this comes down to the core beliefs of the society. If your people believe that the earth is self-sustaining or that divine forces will care for it, then they will probably not invest a lot of time in worrying about their impact on it or their potential losses to it. But if your people see themselves as stewards of the earth who are responsible for its well-being through what they say and what they do, what they think, well, then they may consider their practices more carefully. The Native American peoples, like most traditional, and by traditional I mean low-tech, most traditional people, typically saw themselves as environmental caretakers. When people believe that they have an obligation to their surroundings, maybe because the gods have left it in their care, then they tend to tread lightly in them. But when they believe, as the Christian conquerors and colonists did, that the earth was created exclusively for them to possess and exploit, then they don't worry as much about the consequences of their actions, which means that they're unprepared for their inevitable futures. Modern people change our environment to suit our needs. It's obvious that if we change our environment, we're going to be left to contend with the consequences of those changes. Now, if we know that human beings change our environments, doesn't it stand to reason that the climate might undergo a corresponding change? Aren't the two linked? Don't they interact? Seriously. Consider the impact of skyscrapers in cities, for example. They cast shadows, they cut down on light, they contribute to cooling, create wind tunnels. If you live in the forest, it's typically pretty damp. If you cut down the trees, it gets dry. Simple. There is a contribution that human beings make to their surroundings. Of course, human beings do a lot more than cut down forests, so it stands to reason that we're having an impact on the planet. So can we agree at least that the climate is changing? I mean, who cares why? Does it really matter? Shouldn't we just be dealing with the present reality of increased extreme weather events? Shouldn't we just be dealing with the consequences? There are lives that depend upon it. 2012 saw the warmest spring on record in the continental United States, droughts across the South and Southwest, and wildfires burning more than 1.3 million acres of land in the West. You've heard, of course, about the polar ice caps melting. You've seen the stranded polar bears on the nature shows. But are you aware of the land disputes that are suddenly popping up between Canada, Denmark, the U.S., and Russia over who gets to claim the newly exposed lands in the Arctic? It's a geopolitical fact. As the ice melts and the glaciers recede, the land beneath them gets exposed, thus changing the shape of the continents to which they are attached. And since borders are usually imaginary, it's anyone's guess where my land ends and yours begins. Are you ready for a land dispute with Russia? Now, it's true that geology tells us that the planet has gone through many phases of climate change in the past, and this one could also be a part of that natural cycle, sure. But so what if it is? So what? It's happening, and we have to deal with the reality of its effects. I personally believe that there is a human contribution to climate change, because it stands to reason that the Earth and its atmosphere might respond to the conditions we create. I mean, if trees affect the climate, then obviously we do. We do way more than just stand around growing. Our biosphere is delicate balance whose workings are still beyond our complete comprehension, but every sixth grader knows that every action has an equal and opposite reaction, so clearly our actions must have consequences. So let's talk about Katrina then, because our actions there had tremendous consequences. And I'm not talking about the small things like how high the levees were or why they failed. I'm talking about the big things like why they were even there in the first place. This is what I was referring to before when I talked about how cultures make choices that put themselves at greater risk. Well, here's what I mean. When the lands along the Mississippi were occupied exclusively by Native Americans, the river did what all rivers do. It flooded regularly, just like the Nile in ancient Egypt, the Tigris and Euphrates in ancient Mesopotamia, now Iraq, the Ganges in ancient India. The rivers flooded on a fairly regular basis. So what did people do? Well, they didn't build cities on top of them, that's for sure. No, they traveled some distance to them, or they used temporary encampments around them, or they built their shelters on stilts. In any event, they were prepared for the flooding. They welcomed it, in fact, because floodwaters carry soil and nutrients out of the hills and deposit them on the banks of the river, which make it extremely fertile ground for growing food. So they anxiously awaited the yearly flooding because they needed it to sustain their agricultural way of life. So obviously, they prepared themselves for it. Now, what happened along the Mississippi is that the colonial era caused a shift in priorities. Instead of a rich source of agricultural floodwaters, the river came to be seen as a natural highway for the transport of goods. Those of you who have listened to my previous podcast might recognize this as a transition from an agricultural to an industrial economy, and that's exactly what it was. And when you do that, when you make that shift from focusing on farming and feeding yourself, feeding your family, feeding your village, to focusing instead on the production and sale of material goods, well then, everything changes. Your cultural priorities change, your values change, the way you use and allot your land changes. Even your rates of reproduction change. That's something I talked about in the second podcast, which was on birth control and abortion. In the early 20th century, a massive project was undertaken by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to expand and control the Mississippi in order to accommodate the great new commercial barges that were carrying so much of our economy up and down the river. They constructed a series of locks and dams with two main purposes in mind. First, to maintain a shipping channel that's at least 9 feet deep by 400 feet wide, and second, to keep the river from flooding out its surrounding industrial and port cities. The project was, of course, terrifically successful in accomplishing the first objective, but a bit of geological short-sightedness has caused it to fail at the second. Here's why. The river stopped flooding. I know that was the point, but it's also the problem. Let me explain. When rivers flood, they deposit new soil on the banks, which helps to build up the land. It's called deposition. And then, over time, the new deposits sink and settle. That's called subsidence. So the river regularly drops new earth on the banks, which then sinks down, so that over the years, the land is continually replenished. It's a perfect cycle. So what happened when the Army Corps of Engineers completed its work is that the flooding stopped, but the subsidence didn't. In other words, the land has been sinking for decades without being replenished. Every year, it drops further below sea level. And that's why, when the levees broke and Lake Pontchartrain flooded, the water swept through. It was the lowest ground around. It sinks lower every day, literally. Well, now you might understand why I have mixed feelings about the rebuilding of New Orleans. Certainly I want to see it happen, but I want to see it planned in a pragmatic way. Habitation has to be pulled back from the river's edge, and areas of low ground must be raised and forever maintained. If we're not going to allow the river to flood, then we have to manually replenish the soil that is being depleted on a daily basis. Now, from an archaeological point of view, many human civilizations have collapsed in the past due to climate change, and there's often clear evidence that we had something to do with it. Let's talk for a bit, not about flooding, but drought. The ancient Maya lived throughout southern Mexico, the Yucatan Peninsula, and parts of what is now Guatemala, Belize, and El Salvador from about 4,000 years ago. They practiced a terrifically successful form of agriculture that involved extensive terraced fields and irrigation canals. They grew so much food, so successfully, that their population swelled to include cities over 50,000 people. At the height of their success, the ancient Maya numbered in the millions. This was sometime before about 900 AD. They built plazas and courtyards and monumental palaces, but they're best known for those iconic stepped temple pyramids. And then what happened? It all collapsed. They abandoned their cities at least 500 years before the Europeans ever set foot on the continent. So that was probably the Aztecs in that crappy Mel Gibson movie. And they largely returned to a small village existence. Why? Well, there are a lot of theories, but inarguably, the most prevalent ones talk about drought and overpopulation. Did they cause the drought? Probably not entirely, but there is no doubt that they completely transformed their landscape. Have you seen the photos of those terraced hillsides? It's incredible. And think to yourself, all of that used to be jungle. Wet jungle. The Maya were intensive farmers whose success at producing food was so great that it allowed their populations to grow exponentially, but it also led to extreme deforestation, and then suddenly the land could no longer support them. Did the climate change? Of course it did. As we said, if you live in a forest, then you know it's a damp place. Trees hold water. So what happens if you cut them all down to grow food? Less water, obviously. Whether it was less rainfall or land overuse or overpopulation, whatever it was, the Maya walked away. They abandoned their greatest cities and scaled back their civilization significantly. And the jungle, for its part, took the land back pretty quickly. Some of the most famous Mayan architectural sites were once unknown, having been thoroughly forgotten because they had been so quickly obscured by vegetation. Archaeologists are still finding sites today, like the great city of Holtun, or Head of Stone, which was uncovered only about 20 years ago. A bit closer to home, we have the example of the ancestral Pueblo of North America, who are insultingly referred to as the Anasazi, which means enemy of my people. That was the Navajo word for them. So it's better to refer to them as the ancestral Pueblo. They, too, were farmers who began their journey under far better conditions than they ended it. They lived in the Four Corners region of the U.S. in what is now Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado, from about 100 A.D. until about 1300, near the beginning of what's referred to as the Great Drought, which lasted, I think, about 200 years. So by the time the Europeans arrived, their cliff dwellings had been long abandoned. Whether they themselves had anything to do with the change is unknown, but the site of their last home is currently a desert. And then there's the Akkadian Empire of ancient Mesopotamia, the Khmer civilization of ancient Cambodia. Gone. Archaeologists have found solid evidence of droughts lasting 300 to 500 years preceding the collapse of these cultures. So there is a geological, archaeological precedent for climate change affecting civilization on a tremendous scale. Did they do it to themselves? Probably not. Does it matter? No, they're gone. So we have to address not just the fact of climate change, but our responses to it. We have to see the train that's heading straight at us and get the hell off the tracks. We need to understand what leads us to set up the situations that make our own disasters possible, or at least make them worse than they need to be, so we can be smart about avoiding them in the future. That brings me to Hurricane Sandy. That one's a little more personal for me. I can't help but see it as a failure of planning, a triumph of money over common sense, a case of intentional blindness. My family in the Rockaways is a pretty academic bunch. My brother-in-law in particular has acquired a bit of fame as a marine biologist. He's a sailor, too, and he's very familiar with the coastal waters around New York. And he's been talking about and dreading this flooding event for a really long time. He's witnessed the expansion of apartments into areas closer and closer to the beach, high-density high-rises towering over cement strips with ocean views. Too many people, too little land, too close to the ocean, no realistic evacuation plan. It's a sandbar. The island, it's a sandbar. And like the river we discussed earlier, its nature is to flood and subside. That's the process that created it in the first place, the gradual accumulation of sands in the area. You can't stop it. You just have to be prepared for it. So, if you know that a sandbar is formed by the actions of the ocean and therefore, geologically speaking, a fairly unstable place, why then do you build high-density housing there? If you know that the area will be flooded regularly, why then do you build homes below sea level? If you know that there is a potential danger for the inhabitants, then why do you not have a realistic plan for their evacuation or even their survival in the event of what is essentially an extremely predictable storm? It reminds me of Vesuvius. You remember Vesuvius, that Italian volcano that erupted in 79 AD and totally took out the cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum? Thousands died, like, I don't know, 15 to 20,000. Luckily, the volcano had been belching smoke for a few days. It was long enough for a lot of people to get away before it actually blew, but many others were unaware of it or unable to leave, so there was still quite a lot of life lost. Well, you know what? That volcano is still active. I'm not kidding. It's still active. Only now, instead of tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands, there are millions of people living in its shadow. Ask them if they think about their evacuation plan. I'm guessing it's not foremost on their minds. So what's the explanation? Are they just a bunch of Catholic people who believe that God will protect them, that the active volcano will never again erupt, or are they just too consumed by the day-to-day minutiae of their lives to think about it? 3 million people. I have no answer for Italy. I have only questions. Who can say why people choose to live in the shadow of a volcano? You could say the same thing about San Francisco with its earthquakes, right? Well, no. Actually, wrong. Because California is well aware of its propensity for earthquakes, and so it has building codes that reflect that. A four-story building in San Francisco is safer than a one-room house in Mexico in the event of an earthquake, because the difference is planning. It's time, I think, for America to start really dealing, coping with the effects of climate change. It doesn't matter why the climate is changing, and we're wasting time arguing over the wrong thing anyway. We need to move past the ridiculous dispute about whether or not it's happening to the more productive arguments about how to deal with it. We need to make adjustments in our building practices, in our city planning, in our transportation and public service infrastructure, and we need to do this now, or we risk becoming a real Atlantis, a lost and sunken world. Well, that's it. That's what I've got for you today. Hope you enjoyed it. I have been doing this podcast now for about 2.5 months, and this is podcast number 7. I'd like to thank you all for listening. I know that I've got, close to 200 listeners and somewhere around 50 subscribers, and I'm flattered and grateful. I would dearly love some feedback, folks. I have not received a single phone call or a single email since beginning this project, and I am just a single person alone in a room with a microphone and a computer, and so it would be really great to engage with my audience, with my listeners. So I do hope that some of you will reach out and contact me. You can call me, leave me a message at 206-312-3526. That's 206-312-3526. Call me and leave me a message. Let me know if there's something you'd like to disagree with, some other fact you'd like to point out, a mistake that you think I made, or maybe you have a suggestion for a topic for another show. I would love to hear your feedback on what I've been doing so far. You can also send me an email at theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. That's theanonymousanthropologist@gmail.com. You can go ahead and like me on Facebook. And if you're a Twitter kind of person, I do occasionally tweet at anonymousanthro. That's at anonymousanthro. So again, I'd like to thank you all for listening. Would love to hear from you. Until I speak with you again, be well and take care.
Am I recording?